Hi, welcome to this week's program. I know that people who follow my show and blog are typically well-informed and proactive when it comes to making smart decisions about their money. But that's not what I want to talk about today. I want to try a different approach. And at the risk of sounding contrarian or stirring up anxiety about some of the things which many folks may be not doing well at, things like managing their finances or saving for the future, let's talk instead about some of the biggest mistakes I've seen people make over the course of my long career as a financial planner and advisor. And believe me, I've made some of these mistakes myself. When it comes to steering your financial future, whether in terms of strategies to manage your money, or estate planning, or retirement savings, there are a lot of ways to fall short of your goals. So my hope is that we can learn from our mistakes, and even less painfully learn from the mistakes of others, and also from the collective wisdom of professionals who study this area and make recommendations based on facts, not rumor or innuendo. And I'd like to start with what might seem like a painfully obvious example, and it's one of the worst mistakes you can make in financial planning. What's this terrible mistake? It's not having any plan at all. Some people may avoid creating a plan because they think it's too complicated or their own situation is too hard to resolve. Maybe they don't understand the true value of planning or they don't believe it applies to their situation. My hunch, however, is that most of those without a plan are simply procrastinating. They may think things will work out for themselves or they're waiting to see what happens, hoping that doing nothing will be a good strategy. Or maybe, just maybe, they're avoiding sitting down with a pro because they're afraid of what they'll find out. This is not a winning strategy, no matter how disappointing the news might be. It's like avoiding a leak in your house, hoping that mold won't appear. Mold happens, so you better deal with it. So first, it's imperative to get clarity around your goals and the time frames that you may want to accomplish them. You know, do you want to pay off all your debts in 5 years? Is purchasing a home a realistic goal in the next year or two? How much money will you need if you want to retire in 10 years with the same lifestyle? You know, I know it's sometimes hard to look ahead and get this clarity, but a mental journey into the future can be illuminating and it may end up with great rewards. Another harmful example of avoiding the inevitable is not setting up a routine savings practice. The precise amount of money you set aside at first and the rate of return you earn in the early years is not that important. It's a lot less important than the actual discipline of saving the money in the first place. You can start modestly and gradually inch up the amount if that gets you on track to build your habit of reserving some cash every single week or month. Why is this the key to building financial security? It's the key because having savings in the first place can tap you into the miracle of compound interest, which will only work in your favor if you actually have money saved. You know, we talk a lot about the stock market rising over long periods of time. Well, if you haven't saved anything and haven't put your money to work in that area, you're not going to reap the benefits. You will always be behind the eight ball, as they say. Another sub-benefit of starting to save right now is the message it sends to your children. Let's pass a positive savings trait onto them, starting now to make their futures more secure. I'm talking about financial planning mistakes so many of us make. You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Of course, I am Steve Pomerantz. Continuing on the theme of mistakes that stem from inaction, here's an important one. Not participating in your employer-sponsored pension or retirement plan. Did you know that a staggering 68% of working-age people did not participate in an employer-sponsored plan? If you're not already plugged into these programs, make an appointment with a supervisor or someone from your HR department to get up to speed on the relevant details. Many employers offer matching funds for these plans, so that's the kind of deal you're not going to get anywhere else. Imagine an investment fund that offers a guaranteed 100% annual interest rates. That sounds impossible, right? Well, that's the equivalent of getting your employer's match. It's leaving money on the table, and there's no greater financial sin than leaving money on the table. Another less discussed aspect of planning your financial life takes place in the Social Security arena. You know, getting information about your benefits is easy. Just go to ssa.gov. But there may be possible extra funds for you if you're in a particular situation. Let's say you're divorced and you've remarried. Well, depending on how long you were originally married and some other things, you may be able to kick up your benefits modestly. This is a perfect question for a financial planning professional who should be able to walk you through the maze of legalese involved in taking advantage of this ex-spouse benefit. I want to finish up by pivoting to another area of personal financial management, estate planning. You know, most people fear that estate planning is massively complicated and one they'd rather not think about.
While estate planning can involve a complex web of tax rules and regulations, there are aspects of it that are relatively straightforward. Estate planning should be handled by an attorney rather than a financial advisor, but there are some rudimentary things you can take care of yourself or with the help of an advisor that do not require an attorney's oversight.
For starters, not everyone realizes that it's not only insurance policies which have designated beneficiaries, but so do savings accounts and retirement accounts and some checking accounts at the bank. If you've never named beneficiaries to any of these, do so now. If you have specified beneficiaries in the past, but you've experienced a major life change like marriage or divorce, having children or the death of a spouse or family member, or even if you've received an unexpected windfall, you should review beneficiary designations on all of your accounts and assets. So, what important estate planning issues should you seek counsel on? Well, passing your assets that go to heirs is a prime reason to seek out an attorney. There are many ways to design a will or other trust to comply with probate laws in the state in which you reside. You know, look, for example, an unfortunate scenario that could result is the possibility that your ex-spouse, whom you designated as beneficiary on an account 20 years ago, could inherit the entirety of its value, despite the fact that you stipulated in a living will that your whole estate should be bequeathed to your children. So, I hope you get the idea of my advice to you today. These are basic ideas you should think about. Not planning for your future in an organized way, not good. Not saving for the future, not good. Not knowing what you're entitled to concerning Social Security and other benefits, not great. And not getting your estate affairs in order.
These concepts are just the tip of the iceberg, so hiring a professional in these complicated areas is a very good start.
And remember to only contact those individuals with a certified financial planner designation. This is the most respected and trusted designation in the industry. And for more information on this and a ton of other money topics, from Shark Tank to Gucci to the world's greatest investors, go to our website, stevepomerantz.com. That's P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, stevepomerantz.com.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. You know, your odds of becoming a millionaire aren't what they used to be. They're better. A record number of U.S. households have reached that enviable goal. I've asked Sandra Block to join me to outline the five routes to success. Sandra is Senior Associate Editor for Kiplinger's Personal Finance. Hey, Sandra, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Five routes to success. Sounds simple. Is this one of those things that's simple but not easy?
Yeah, it's not rocket science, but it does require a certain amount of discipline that many people find hard. And in fairness, too, oftentimes people do have setbacks that they, you know, aren't responsible for that can get in the way of getting there. But the steps aren't, you know, genius. They're just requires that you school yourself.
Mm-hmm. And exhibit some discipline to try to, you know, get to your goal.
That's right.
You know, a lot of the ways that people think that high net worth households have accumulated their wealth is mostly with stocks, but that's not necessarily true, is it?
No, it's across the board. I mean, I think in terms of your long-term investing, stocks do have the greatest potential for growth, and people who invest regularly and early in the stock market have the greatest chance of getting to $1 million nest egg by the time they retire. Mm-hmm. But that's just one piece of the puzzle. Obviously, your income, your earnings are a big part of that. And one of the things we point out is that people who start their own businesses, even though it's risky and a lot of businesses fail, you control your destiny that way. And those folks have a really good chance of reaching $1 million if they have a successful business and find a niche that grows. I think that was one of the points made in the classic Millionaire Next Door. The survey found that most of the millionaires he talked to did own their own businesses, because then you're not relying on a boss to give you a raise.
And we're not talking about having to be the next Google or the next Uber. We're talking about just good, small to maybe even slightly medium-sized businesses where, you know, you can build in a good profit margin and, you know, hire just enough people and keep the rest for yourself.
That's right. And you find a niche that there's room for. And in stories I've written before about people who start their own businesses, one of the things that experts say is you should start a business with the idea that someday you will sell it to someone bigger. And that's how people really get rich.
Yeah.
You start a business that somebody, you know, some huge entity, and we see this practically every day, you know, when Facebook buys some app or something like that, you know, the ability to scale up is key to really making a lot of money as a business owner. But, you know, to start out, it's just a matter of finding a market where there's a need.
Well, you know, if you think about it, and we're going off topic here just a little bit, but I enjoy talking about this stuff. So, you know, what creates wealth in the case of a business? Well, you know what it is? It's net cash flow. It's the amount that you're getting out of the business. That cash flow has a value to someone, and someone's willing to pay a multiple on that value. So if you've got, you know, cash flow of $1,000, someone may be willing to pay $10,000 for that. And that means that they're earning a 10% return. They're spending 10 and they're getting 1,000. That's 10%. So it's that multiple factor that creates this wealth. If the company will pay you 20 times earnings or even 5 times earnings, that can do a lot for you. So without beating that up too much, I think we've covered that. So investments, having your own business. What about inheritance? You know, there's this sense in America that, you know, people with inheritances are a large part of becoming a millionaire. Is that true?
Well, I think people need to be realistic about the likelihood that they will inherit money, because as people live longer and healthcare costs go up, I think it's a bad planning error to assume that your parents are going to leave you a lot of money. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that baby boomers are sitting on a lot of assets, and some of those assets will pass to their children. And the windfall can be, you know, modest or large, but it offers so many opportunities for more growth, whether you inherit $50,000 or $250,000 or more. If nothing else, you can use that to, you know, get out of debt.
Yeah.
You can invest it. The key is, whatever the windfall is, to look for a way to use it that it will get larger. That's how a windfall helps you become a millionaire.
It's saving a dollar today with the idea that you're going to get something far greater than a dollar in the future, and that's what you're going to count on.
That's right.
Yeah. So what are some of the obstacles here, you know, to becoming a millionaire? I know one that comes to my mind is that as soon as a person gets a raise, they start to spend more. Is living large one of the obstacles?
It is a really big, experts call that lifestyle creep. You know, you get more money, so you decide to buy a bigger house or a sports car or something like that. And the problem is that these types of expenditures don't increase your overall wealth. In fact, they can decrease it, because the cars depreciate. Houses actually might be a good investment, but they, you know, cost a lot of money to maintain them. And the bigger the house, the more you're going to spend on maintenance.
Yeah.
So the idea that that you have to increase your living standards as your income increases is going to prevent you from reaching this goal. And again, you know, in The Millionaire Next Door, what they found was that the millionaires next door didn't live like millionaires. They drove old cars. They lived in the smallest house in a nice neighborhood. And that's really the key, because it's just so easy to let your lifestyle get away from you.
You mentioned The Millionaire Next Door. That's a book that was written many, many years ago. It's still in print, I'm sure. So anybody listening here, just go ahead and get that book. It's a fascinating book. And it's the guy next door that's driving the old Ford pickup truck who you don't really know what's worth. He's not living as if he's worth. You know, the extreme example of that is Warren Buffett.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and obviously he can have any house or car that he wants, but he has, you know, lived modestly and basically from the beginning lived modestly and just reinvested everything that he got. And, you know, all of his earnings he put back into his portfolio. And that's sort of, again, how you keep your money working for you instead of putting it something static where it just buys something that costs money to keep.
Yeah. And don't forget, if you buy a car, you buy an expensive car, it's a beautiful thing. It's a joy to own, but that car depreciates over time. It does not necessarily become more valuable later. And everything you want to think about with your money beyond, you know, your basic consumables is, you know, is this thing going to be worth more later? All right, so let's talk about ways to, get to that millionaire level here? Number one, automate your savings. Talk about that.
Yeah, that's basically the idea. I mean, it's a typical 401k plan. The money goes into your account before you see it. And that's how I think the most effective way for people, particularly when they're young, to get started. You can't spend what you don't have. There's tons of studies that show now that if people are automatically signed up for a 401k plan, they won't opt out. But if you ask them to opt in, they won't get around to it. So, you know, just put it on autopilot so you live with, again, that's a good way to prevent lifestyle creep. And then make sure that as your income increases, the amount that you automatically have taken from your accounts increases too.
Also, if you don't have access to a 401k, you can always do an IRA. And one idea is to pay yourself first.
That's right.
Be the first monthly bill that you pay, because that's going to pay off in spades later on. The next one here is invest in yourself. You have a good story here about a person who was the hearing child of deaf parents. Take us through that.
That's right. And she basically, her parents owned a computer store back in the 80s when they had big computers. And a small part of their business provided assistive devices for the deaf and hard of hearing. And she saw a need there. And she basically bought out the company. Her mother was a co-owner and started a company providing, you know, very high quality interpretive services to Social Security, to local governments, domestic violence centers, courtrooms. And at the time that she started the business, there were only a handful of companies doing this. So she grew very fast. She's very dedicated to the deaf community and, you know, had a very healthy profit margin. It shrunk a little because more companies have gotten into it, but it's a growing business. And basically, she saw a need and she filled it and grew the company very fast.
Yeah, she started off. The company had annual revenues of about $800,000 in 2015 and three employees, but it grew to 62 employees and more than $6 million in annual revenues. And I can tell you that creates a lot of wealth, that kind of money, that's for sure.
Yes, it does. And, yeah. And especially with the kind of profit margins that she was getting. So that's wealth. And you know, and in her case, too, I think there's a great amount of satisfaction in what she does as well, because a lot of the services they provide are to underserved hard of hearing people who, you know, often are in a situation where they're traumatized or, you know, are having difficulties, and they can help these people.
Another idea here is to channel Warren Buffett. We mentioned him a little bit earlier as a way to not experience lifestyle creep, but what other ways can we channel Warren Buffett for success?
Well, basically, you know, Warren Buffett says that, you know, that as long as there's capitalism in this country, you can make money buying shares of good companies and buying them and holding them, you know, forever. And basically, you know, it's a little hard for some people to think about doing that now because the stock market has done so well and they're worried about, you know, how long is this bull market? And there's a lot of things going on in the world that make people nervous. But, you know, the tried and true strategy is just to, you know, buy good companies and hold on to them and don't try and time the market. And I think the other thing that is useful now is there's so many ways you can invest in the market, invest in a diversified portfolio for very, very low cost. You know, you can buy index funds, you can buy ETFs.
Right.
So you're not giving a lot of money away.
Right. I agree.
To manage it, but you can get a really broad diversification of stocks and other investments.
Unfortunately, Sandra, we are out of time. Boy, that went really fast. Sandra Block joins me. She's a senior associate editor for Kiplinger's Personal Finance. And where can people find you, Sandra?
This story is on Kiplinger.com.
Very good. Sandra Block would be the person with the byline. Thank you so much for joining us. And to hear this conversation again, don't forget to join us and to join this conversation at stevepomerantz.com. Thank you, Sandra. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Are there any topics we're missing, guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show, questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z,
www.tax-rules-and-regs.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. How's this for a book title? How to Get Approved for the Best Mortgage Without Sticking a Fork in Your Eye. Well, that's a book that we really wanted to talk about because sometimes getting a mortgage is like sticking a fork in your eye. And I've got the person to talk right about it. This is the author of the book, Alicia Stobe, and she's with me right now. Hi, Alicia. Welcome.
Hello. Thanks for having me, Steve.
So let's just get into the process now of getting a mortgage. Why does it seem so difficult?
Well, the pendulum swung to the opposite direction since the mortgage crisis of 2008, and everybody's being held to the lowest common denominator, unfortunately. That's the bad news, so there's a lot of paperwork. The good news is rates are still low, and you can get approved for a mortgage. My book walks people through what to expect so people aren't shocked, because we can't change, obviously, what the banks and the government is now requiring since all the mortgage regulation. But if people have an understanding of it, it makes the whole process easier, and they also understand why the lenders are asking for what they're asking for and how to give it to them in a timely manner. And it does make the process smoother and easier, and so people can close on time on their new homes.
You know, we talk to mortgage brokers all the time, and one of them said to me the other day, you know, because people complain so bitterly about all the paperwork, and his response was, you know, I don't want to do the paperwork either, you know, don't blame me. So it's like, yeah, you know, he just has to do what he has to do. It's really not his fault. You're a mortgage broker, am I correct?
Correct. I've been in the industry for 13 years.
All right, so you're doing this every single day, and you're seeing all kinds of borrowers and all kinds of properties. And what would be some of the first steps someone should do in order, when they know that they're going to need a mortgage? How can you help? What kind of advice can you give them?
Well, I strongly believe that an educated consumer is always our best client. So when it comes to doing the research, I have three monumental money mistakes to avoid. And the first thing that people don't do is they rush out and they just go shopping. And some realtors will take them out, and I believe that's a grave mistake, because when it comes to tax deductions and income and how it flows through an income tax return, what people think they make may not actually be what they claim they make.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, they may not be on purpose at all, but often people don't always have the same understanding of how the numbers are looked at by underwriters. So I strongly encourage people to actually get approved, not pre-qualified, but rather pre-approved, and have the lender review the documents so they actually are shopping in the correct price range. And they know what they're looking for when it comes to payment, whether that be for a single-family home or a condominium, because those can vary, and there are different loan programs for each of those. I believe also it's very important for the borrower to understand their loan options. So especially right now for first-time home buyers, there are plenty of options. With conventional, there's as little as 3% down. You can go FHA, 3.5%. And even though that seems like a minor thing, only a 0.5% difference in the down payment, those two loan types are very different and have very different fees involved when it comes to upfront funding as well as on a monthly basis. And it's very important for the borrower to understand their options and how their payments can change with that.
So if you go for the house first and you fall in love with something, you may find that you don't qualify for a mortgage for whatever reason. So your advice is best, go for the mortgage first. Now, there's a difference between being pre-qualified and approved or pre-approved, right? What is the difference?
Correct. Yes, the difference between pre-qualified is basically you do your loan application either over the phone or online with a lender. They pull your credit. You run through all the questions in the loan application, but you're not really having the lender review your documents, your income tax returns, and your savings and your checking. And so they don't really have a true picture of what your finances really look like.
Yeah, there's a lot of confusion there.
Exactly. And so, for instance, I mentioned the income tax return, but let's say, for example, you know, you have, I don't know, $20,000 you think you're going to use in a down payment, and those funds actually aren't accessible, and you don't really know that because you haven't researched, you know, how much you can pull out of your 401k as a first-time home buyer and how that works. So the lender can review all those with you before you actually go shopping, so you really, you truly know your buying power. And also, it looks a lot stronger to a seller to have a pre-approval instead of a pre-qualification.
Yes.
And in some markets, in fact, some markets are hotter than others across the country. The hotter markets require a pre-approval and will not take a pre-qualification.
Mm-hmm. So how does someone shop properly for a mortgage? There's been some statistics that I've seen that says most people lose their shopping acuity when it comes to big financial decisions. They'll only find one lender, and if that person's very nice and easy to work with, they'll just stick with that person. What do you recommend there?
Anybody that actually reaches out to us, we have a checklist that we encourage them to shop around and ask questions. Just a few of those would be, what type of references do you have? What type of licenses do you have? And I think references are very important, especially in this day and age. It's very easy to research multiple lenders online through websites such as Trulia or right. Zillow, mm-hmm. Better Business Bureau. And I would look for at least two or three of those sources that say that lender and that particular loan officer, licensed loan officer, is outstanding. It's the largest purchase people typically make in their entire life, and I think it's very important to take it seriously.
What is the differential between lenders themselves? So not talking about the broker, but from one bank to another or one lending organization to another. Are there big differences between pricing, or is it pretty much all commoditized?
That's an excellent question. There are actually, a lot of it is commoditized, but there are very subtle nuances between lenders. So for example, the FHA program has certain standards, but every lender, since they're actually lending their money from their bank, has their own overlays, is what they're called in the industry. So FHA actually may not have a credit score minimum, but most lenders will put either a 580 minimum or a 620 minimum. So if you went to one bank and their minimum credit score was 620, but the bank down the road actually is 580, well, then the 620 bank minimum would turn you down, but the bank that has the 580, and hypothetically, if your score was 600,
yeah,
the one with 580 would be able to help you. And if you don't go to that other bank, you'll never know. So another question I encourage people to ask is, what's your closing ratio of your number of loans that you originate? How many do you actually close? And unfortunately, the national statistic is less than 50% across
wow.
the country.
Yeah.
So it's disturbing, because if you look at that statistic and think, if people are already in a contract, they have their earnest money deposit in jeopardy of being lost. Or worse yet, they could have lost that and think they're moving in, and they could be moving out of their rental or have sold their other home and not have anywhere to go. So it's very important to look at all the different nuances that each bank offers. And that can vary by region. That can vary by, you know, from big bank to big bank even. Some of them have a, you know, riskier appetite
yeah.
for loans, you know, and some don't.
You know, many years ago, I worked for a division of Chase Manhattan, their investment division, and we worked with their high net worth or their jumbo loan division. And I noticed that from time to time, the bank basically stated that they had enough loans, you know, they wanted to stop doing loans, but they couldn't stop. So what they would do is they would jack the rates up, and that would slow down, you know, they would become uncompetitive, so to speak, for a period of time. So is there a differential in rates between these, let's say, large institutions, or are they just kind of close enough? Where is the skinny there? Is it in the points? Is it in the rate? What should we look for?
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that. Banks still do that. When they're busy, the way they do slow down their incoming pipeline is they will raise their rates.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to shop. And the interesting thing is the consumer really has to shop with their credit score and their true credentials. So they truly should be at least pre-qualified, if not pre-approved. And to get the best rates, they need to shop on the same day. Because when I first got in this industry, if rates changed by an eighth or a quarter over 6 weeks, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
But now with everything being so
right.
hyper-reactive because mm-hmm. of the electronic age and all our access to instant information, rates can change anywhere from an eighth to a quarter depending on the volatility of the market
absolutely.
On a daily basis. That's not customary, but sometimes we have more market volatility in the stock market, it affects the bond market, and then that's affecting interest rates the same way.
Exactly. The book is How to Get Approved for the Best Mortgage Without Sticking a Fork in Your Eye. My guest is Alicia Stobe, the author of that book and a mortgage broker herself. Unfortunately, Alicia, we are out of time, but thank you so much for the information. What website can people get to you at?
The book's for sale on Amazon, so if they look up Alicia Stobe Books, E-L-Y-S-I-A, Stobe, S-T-O-B-B-E, books, plural.com, that'll give us the links right to the site. Or if they go to Alicia Stobe homeloans.com. That's our blog, and they can also find me on Twitter and LinkedIn and Facebook as well.
Well, thank you for joining our conversation.
Thanks. Appreciate it, Steve.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky, and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, purchasing a home has just become a lot cheaper thanks to the fact that the Federal Reserve decided to stop raising interest rates. The market really reacted to that, and interest rates have come down dramatically. The 30-year fixed rate, according to this article, is now at just hovering over 4%, which is down from over 5% just a few months ago. Are you seeing that out there?
I sure am. It's awesome news. And the buyers are coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah,
it's amazing how that works.
Well, I mean, when interest rates drop 1%, that sure makes housing, the monthly payment, much more affordable.
Oh, absolutely. And they're recognizing it and they're seeing it. And you know what's funny, Steve? If the interest rates go up, the buyers jump out of the woodwork too. So I think they should just move it up, down, up, down, up, down.
That's not very nice. Well, they're anticipating they want to catch the rates while they're low.
Correct.
Right?
And as they're rising, they're afraid, oh, it's going to go up higher.
That's
so I better jump in before
it's
too late.
But at a certain point, they just close the valve, they shut the valve,
that's
and they
right.
go
and
on vacation.
Like, right. And they're like, well, we'll just wait. I'm sure it'll come back down. And then they don't. And then that's when we get all nervous as agents.
That's
and
right.
then they drop them and then they come back out. It's fun. Good stuff.
So are you seeing a big pickup in your business?
Yeah, actually, Steve, I've been doing this for 30 years. And this past month was the most pending sales I've ever had in 30 years. So that says a lot. We put a lot of contracts together.
So how many pending sales you have out there now?
Over 20.
Wow.
Which is really, really a lot.
How long does it take for the average house to close versus the time the contract is written?
Sure. Well, contracts close. So once it's signed to close, on average is 45 days.
Mm-hmm.
People will ask for 30 to 60 days. So we'll go with an average of 45 days.
Okay. So you've got over 20 homes in the pipeline that are going to be closing.
Right.
What percentage of those
close?
Actually do end up closing?
It's very high for me because we really do our homework. It's well into the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
We do have an occasional fall through. But Steve, you'd think the fall through would be mortgage. It's not. Our number one fall through is just the inspection.
Of course.
And the buyers this go around are getting aggressive in what they're asking the seller to take care of. You know, before it would be, well, I'm so happy I got the house. I'm not going to ask the seller for anything. Now, they're coming up with a laundry list of nitpicky, ridiculous small items. And in many cases, they're in the driver's seat again.
So you're feeling pretty strongly that we're in a buyer's market.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Especially depending on the price point. But absolutely, we
are.
Okay,
well, let's talk about price points.
Sure.
But first of all, that is a different answer than you gave me, let's say, 6 weeks ago, where you were says kind of on the fence. It was a balance.
Right. And all of that really has to do with price points. So for example, the ones that I'm sharing that the buyers are being aggressive in what they're asking for, these are closer to the $1 million mark.
Okay.
And they are in the driver's seat, the buyers. When you get to a more balanced market, in our market, it's say 500-600, it can go either way.
Yeah.
And then when you're in the lower price range, say under 3, even 4,
mm-hmm.
the sellers are still in control. So they're like, hey, we're not going to take care of it. So if you don't like it, oh, well, next.
So what are we seeing? We're seeing aggressive bidding on these higher priced homes. You got a $1 million home. And their first offer is low? I mean, are they, how is that?
They're not doing so much that. The sellers are having to reduce their price to a price point where it becomes attractive to the buyer.
Mm-hmm.
And I have one particular case where we are in a multiple offer situation on a $900,000 home. We accepted the one offer. It fell apart during the inspection period for no real reason. The second buyer came back into the picture, but this time they're like, ah, no, we're not going to pay the price that we offered you. We're now going to pay you $20,000 less. Oh, and by the way, you're going to take care of every little thing that could humanly possibly be wrong with this house, which it was a newer built house, and there's really hardly anything there.
So how did that go? Did they do it?
We accepted it, and we're having to take care of things that are just over the charts.
It's a little humiliating, right?
It is very humiliating. But that's the market.
It's just business.
So it's a shift. To me, that's the clear sign that we are absolutely in a shift.
Yeah. All right. So the deals, if you can afford it, the deals are in the upper end of the market. They're moving slower.
Correct.
And you've got some negotiating or bargaining power there. In the lower parts of the market, it's kind of like, nah, I mean, the prices are such a price point that there's not a lot of wiggle room.
That's right, because there's a lot of buyers out there. The demand is high.
Yeah. Well, we've seen mortgage applications jump 9% last week. Now, I've been saying this for a while because I've obviously every day I'm watching the interest rates.
That's right.
And they've been coming down for a little while now, but we haven't really started to see any evidence in the mortgage market, but now we are.
That's right.
Right. So people are gotten wind of it, and those who are looking to buy a house are, you know, kind of jumping up and down, and they're taking out mortgages.
Yep.
That's cool. That's cool. Okay. So there's also a big change coming in the market with regards to those who are self-employed getting mortgages. And I have to say right up front that this is huge.
This is great news. I'm self-employed, so yay. Yeah. I can even get a mortgage.
Well, you know, the self-employed person really represents a lot of the wealth in the United States. And historically, they've had more difficulty getting mortgages because the way the mortgage system is set up, you have these big mortgage companies like Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, and they work through lenders and they have these applications that have to be filled out. And it's very hard to kind of figure out the income stream of a self-employed. You know, you're a good
That's
example
right.
of this, right?
Yep.
I mean, some months great, other months
Starving.
Zero. And that's just the way small business works and self-employed works. So they haven't really had the technology to deal with it, but now they do.
Yeah, this is great news. I'm excited because, you know, what's one of the first questions I ask when I'm working with somebody is, are you self-employed?
Yeah.
Not that I care that they're self-employed or not, but I know what kind of headaches we're going to have and that they need to start their mortgage process well in advance of us starting our house hunting.
Well, I think that's going to change because here's a quote. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac rolled out automated underwriting technology changes for lenders that take a lot of the guesswork and risk out of the approval process when the self-employed apply for a mortgage loan. Lenders have been reluctant to approve loans for the self-employed because, in part, it's expensive, time-consuming, and labor-intensive to gather and analyze the paperwork needed to verify income and to gauge risk. It's so much easier with a salaried employee.
Sure.
You know, give me 18 months or 24 months of your salary, your paycheck.
The tax returns themselves.
The tax returns.
I know.
Oh,
They're like 10 inches
thick.
Yeah,
you got to plow through K-1s and all of this stuff.
Right.
So this is very good news. And I think this is really going to be a big boom for the housing industry. So we said it here.
Yes.
Okay. We'll see if I'm right. So we are out of time for this segment. Terry always joins me every single week. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies. Thank you.
listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. As the 2019 Berkshire Hathaway Annual Meeting cycles around once more, I've gone back into the archives to pull out a terrific interview with one of the world's most successful investors. Let's see how much of his philosophy still rings true today. Enjoy. John Rogers Jr. might not be a name many of you recognize, but he stands alongside the world's most successful investors. He's listed in the distinguished book, The World's 99 Greatest Investors, along with others like Warren Buffett, Sir John Templeton, and Benjamin Graham. John is chairman, CEO, and chief investment officer and lead portfolio manager of the Ariel Fund, which he founded in 1983. I've asked him to join me today to help us get our arms around this complicated thing called investing. John Rogers Jr., hey, John, thanks for taking the time to talk with us today.
Sure, glad to do it.
So, what age did you start getting interested in investing?
Well, I was very fortunate. My father started buying stocks for me when I was 12 years old. At first, it wasn't fun because, you know, he would give me stocks for Christmas instead of toys and stocks for birthday presents instead of toys. But eventually, I just came to fall in love with the stock market and fall in love with investing. I loved getting the dividend checks in the mail, and I loved reading the annual reports about the various companies that he was investing his money in for me. And it just became a passion for me.
Just kind of a little nerdy thing you had going on there, I guess, right?
I guess it was. Not many of my friends had a shared experience. But eventually I found some friends who loved the markets too and had a chance to, you know, have dialogue with them as I was growing older.
So when you grew older and you began seriously in the investment field, who were your heroes and mentors?
Well, in the beginning, you know, I had a stockbroker across the street from campus at Princeton, and I had my father's stockbroker in Chicago, who actually was the first African-American stockbroker on LaSalle Street in Chicago. And those are my two early mentors and two early role models. And then I went to work at William Blair & Company here in Chicago when I graduated from Princeton, and I became a stockbroker there. So I had a couple role models there. You know, Mr. Blair was still alive, who founded William Blair, and Ned Janata, the managing partner of William Blair, was a terrific mentor and really helped me get established in the investment world. But then, of course, as I was starting to think about leaving Blair after 2.5 years and starting Ariel, I learned about, you know, people like John Templeton and Warren Buffett, Peter Lynch, and they were sort of early role models. And people, I said, geez, they were out there with their own distinctive investment approach, and they were outperforming their peers. And I said, I really want to try and do that, too. I want to start a mutual fund and compete against everyone and with my own unique approach to investing.
Yeah, so they were individuals that went against the crowd, or they lived in their own world and did what they wanted to do, mostly unaffected by the crowd. Was that something that particularly attracted you?
It really was. I remember reading about John Templeton and Warren Buffett in John Train's book, The Money Masters.
Yeah.
And I was just attracted by this independent thinking that they had and this ability to stand alone and not care what the crowd thought. And maybe because I grew up in Hyde Park, you know, part of the University of Chicago community, where I think it's always been known for a lot of independent thinkers. So it just sort of resonated with me when I found out you could be successful as an investor by investing differently than everyone else.
So how hard was it for an African-American to start a mutual fund? You were located in Chicago, right?
I was. It was great to be here in Chicago. That was helpful because, you know, my family was here and there was a history of successful African-American entrepreneurs. George Johnson, who created Johnson Products, and John Johnson, who created Ebony and Jet Magazine. And so there was a history of people starting early and doing something unique as entrepreneurs here in Chicago from the African-American perspective. But it was a challenge because since there had never been an African-American money manager or a mutual fund in the country's history, you know, it would really was difficult getting people to think about you as a serious investor and getting people to trust their endowment dollars or their pension dollars or their 401k dollars with you. You know, that was a real, real challenge just because there was just no role models out there doing what I was trying to do back in 1983.
Well, let's take a look at your investing style a little bit. By the way, I'm speaking with John Rogers Jr. He is the chairman, CEO, chief investment officer, lead portfolio manager of the Ariel Fund. That's A-R-I-E-L, the Ariel Fund, which he founded in 1983. You know, you stated that the stocks you like best are weighed down by behavioral biases. And in your Forbes article last year, you wrote about three of the most common behavioral quirks you try to exploit. But get into this idea of using behavior as a thesis for investing successfully?
Well, you know, it's interesting that from the very beginning when I started, I understood that psychology was a part of the stock market. And David Drimmon, who wrote The Contrarian Investment Strategy, talked about psychology back in the early 80s. And it just became kind of an academic field, I would say, in the last 15 years, where it's become a very serious endeavor in the academic world. Kahneman won the Nobel Prize when he was at Princeton for behavioral finance issues. There's people like Dick Thaler and Toby Moskowitz at the University of Chicago who are doing extraordinary work in this field. So there's a lot more interest in behavioral finance and how it can impact and maybe find a way to outperform the stock market in a very efficient market. We know this is a hard game to play. It's hard to beat those indexes. And maybe the one way you can do it is if you have the ability to not succumb to the normal human behaviors that we all have as a part of us.
Well, Chicago was really the epicenter of the efficient market theory ideology. You know, the idea that markets were efficient, that you really couldn't find irregularities or inefficiencies in the market. In other words, in order to beat the market. But it's funny, you come from those schools, and yet you didn't adhere to that.
Well, it's really interesting. You know, I went to the University of Chicago's high school, and I'm a trustee there, and I've gotten to know a lot about, you know, some of the great professors there that are so well known for their theories on efficient markets. You know, people like Gene Fama, who just recently won the Nobel Prize, you know, is fiercely a believer in this. But, and of course, when I was at Princeton, I had got a chance to know Bert Malkiel, who wrote A Random Walk Down Wall Street, and another great leader of the efficient market hypothesis. But I think at the same time, there's this ongoing debate, and it's interesting, at Chicago, you have these professors who've really been so innovative from a behavioral standpoint, and they're having an ongoing debate and argument with people like Fama around whether you can really make a go of this and outperform consistently over time if you can really capture the essence of understanding how these behaviors can impact your decision-making in a negative way.
Let's examine, John, some of these behavioral biases or quirks. The first one is anchoring. What is anchoring, and what do you do with it once you recognize it?
I think it's probably, for us, it's the most important one. And anchoring means, a good example of anchoring is often a company will have an earnings disappointment. You know, they'll come out and say, you know, we're just not going to meet our earnings estimates for this year and next year, and here are the reasons why. And immediately, you know, the analysts will start to take their earnings estimates down. But inevitably, because they're anchored in the old earnings world, they will be slow to truly have new earnings estimates that properly reflect the new bad news and the new bad world. They're sort of hanging on by a thread to their old estimates. So maybe they should have moved the estimates down, let's just say from $3 to $2. They move them down to 250, and they're slow to get it to where it needs to be. So that means for us, if we own a stock that has an earnings disappointment, we're not going to go in and buy more tomorrow when the stock is down 20%, because we feel like eventually all the bad news hasn't been reflected, but eventually it will be, and then the stock inevitably will be lower as the market realizes this new bad news and the damage that's truly been done to its earnings power. And if we're patient and wait, we'll be able to pick up that stock at a much lower price.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because that is a phenomenon you see all the time. Even when companies start to do better and earn more, analysts are less willing to increase their earnings estimates as well. So they anchor on that. I'm speaking with John Rogers Jr. He is listed in the distinguished book, The World's 99 Greatest Investors, along with others like Warren Buffett, Sir John Templeton, and Benjamin Graham. Let's get to the second one, which is recency bias. What is recency bias?
That often is when people will get swept up of what's the recent news, and it'll play way too much of a dramatic effect on their ability to appropriately analyze a business or a company. So an example would be, you know, we own some of the cruise line companies, and it wasn't long ago that the Carnival was hurt by one of their ships, the Corsica ship, had an accident that was terrible. It was a, you know, great human tragedy. And of course, all the cruise stocks went down immediately because everyone was afraid that, oh, people will be dying on cruise ships. And, you know, once you got beyond that, you realized over time that, you know, it's very rare that anyone dies on a cruise ship, much less than, you know, driving a car down the street. Then eventually it gets back to normal. People realize that the brand hasn't been permanently damaged. And all that current information really shouldn't have impacted the price of the stock that much.
All right, the third one is mental shortcuts. What's a good example of using a mental shortcut and how it can hurt or help you?
Well, I think one of the things that, you know, Charlie Babrinsky, our vice chairman, often talks about is we all use our gut too much, and the data is what matters. So the mental shortcuts are, you know, you'll say that this company that I'm looking at reminds me of another company that I used to own that went up a lot, you know, and so I go into this with sort of this bias that this is going to be a great investment for me, and I don't take the time to really analyze that company in depth and get all the data about the profit margins and the growth rate and the quality of the people and the moat around the industry, and you're too quick to jump into something because it appears to be good and maybe reminds you of something that you've owned in the past that was successful.
Do people use mental shortcuts because it's just so hard to wade through all of the data that's hitting us? We're just trying to figure out, you know, some couple of easy metrics to make a decision, so we create these shortcuts?
Exactly. And we all do it in life. You know, you take shortcuts, and it's just better to be prudent and take the time to take, you know, if you're going to be a successful investor, there are no shortcuts to this. You've got to know that company really, really, really well. You know, as Warren Buffett often says, stay within your circle of competence. So you know that company, that industry better than everyone else. You'll make better decisions because of it. But it takes effort. It takes work. It means getting up early and staying up late and working on weekends and drilling in. And, you know, it's like saying this last thing, you know, looking at the basketball, you know, the great players are the players that took that time to work on their left hand and work on their right hand and come to practice early and shoot hours a day.
Yeah.
There's no shortcut to excellence.
Yeah, if you go to a golf tournament and you see these great players, I mean, they're on the driving range as soon as possible. They're always putting, even though their game is over or whatever, they're still at it, still trying to perfect it. You know, as an investment advisor myself, I talk to a number of people who do their own investing, and, you know, they may buy and hold or they may trade actively, and some say they're successful, many are not. But I think for the most part, this idea of investing seems relatively easy because it's so easy to buy and sell a stock. Everything is so liquid, and if you can buy a stock and it can go up, it just seems like a good gamble. What do you say to that?
Well, we were just talking to our interns last night, our new class of 8 interns, and I was saying that, you know, it's hard to really get to know a company really, really well, and it makes more sense to work with an advisor that you trust, that you've done your homework on, you know is really, really terrific, than to go out and try to do all this on your own. You know, and I really do believe that. And the world's just gotten so much more complicated. There's so many more companies. There's so much challenges. So unless you really, really love it, work with a professional that's going to help you through this economic maze that we all have to live through.
Next, I asked John to tell us if the stock market in 2014 is in a bubble and if stock prices were too high and therefore too risky. Was his prediction correct? Here's his response. I'm speaking with John Rogers, Jr. He is chairman and CEO and chief investment officer and lead portfolio manager at the Ariel Fund. He's also in the book, The World's 99 Greatest Investors. So let's talk about the market today. Now, there was a time in the 1970s when Warren Buffett exclaimed that he felt like an oversexed guy in a harem because there were so many attractive choices for him to invest in. He just couldn't, you know, he couldn't kind of figure out what to decide to buy because there was so much. But 5 years earlier than that, he actually closed his partnership, returned investors money because he couldn't find anything to buy. So, you know, the common question I get today is, number one, are we in a bubble? And number two, aren't we expecting some kind of a terrible crash? What do you think about today's stocks? Are you able to find anything reasonably priced?
Yeah, there's a lot there. I'll start with the last part of your question. First, I think that it's harder to find new ideas, for sure. It's not like it was 6 years ago. Mm-hmm. Every year it gets tougher and tougher, and there are fewer and fewer sectors that are cheap and out of favor. And you have to really look at something that's, you know, really under a cloud to find anything that appears to be bargain priced. So definitely harder to find ideas. But I don't think this is anywhere close to a bubble. And, you know, you don't see the kind of insanity that we saw at the internet bubble at its height. I think we're maybe overvalued, but not nearly bubble territory. And as Warren talked about at the annual meeting last month, as long as we can keep the interest rates low, you know, stock prices are reasonably valued. Now, I don't think he's going to be out there like he did, you know, in the height of the financial crisis saying it's time to buy American companies.
Yeah.
He realizes that eventually as interest rates go higher, P/E ratios will compress, and inevitably we'll have a correction. So at the end of the day, I think it's a time to be cautious, but don't be fearful that we're going to come into any kind of 2008, 2009 crisis or any kind of collapse like we have with the internet bubble collapsed.
I mean, I don't have it on any authority at all, but when you look at what Warren's really buying, he's buying more of what he already owns, but he's taking private companies and he's folding them in to Berkshire Hathaway. I don't really see him going out there whole hog and buying a whole lot of publicly traded stocks at these levels. I don't know if you see the same thing.
I agree, and I think he's being cautious. You know, you kind of read between the lines because he said he thinks interest rates ultimately will go higher, and so therefore, ultimately, he's just saying that the market, you know, has some downside to it in this environment.
Yeah. Let's talk finally about one of your efforts to help with financial literacy. The Ariel Community Academy is where students are challenged with opportunities that are real world based, and you help them manage portfolios. We've got about a minute left. What is that, and where can we find some information about that?
Well, you know, we started the Ariel Community Academy almost 20 years ago when Arne Duncan worked at Ariel, and well before he got to be the cabinet secretary and head of the education department. And we believe that if you're going to have a small public school that a financial services company is involved in, it would make sense for us to teach the kids about the stock market and investing and saving. And we ultimately do give the kids real money to invest and let them make real choices and work with our analysts on how to do research on companies. And when they graduate from eighth grade, they get to keep a portion of the profits that they've been able to create with their own money. And we try to expose them to as much as possible over the years. We've taken them to the McDonald's annual meeting where I'm on the board of directors, and we bring in financial services executives to come and talk to the kids to be role models for those young people. So we're really fully immersed in this. And the final thing I would say, I think because of the success of it, President Obama asked me to chair his council on financial capability for young Americans. And so we've been really trying to take the Ariel model and talk about it throughout the country, and hopefully inspire other financial services companies to partner with urban schools the way that we have.
For more information about Ariel, go to www.arielinvestments.com. Hey, John, that was a great interview. Thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was fun.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show was obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.